The following presentation was recorded at a Faith Builders colloquy. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
Thank you, Tim, for a very masterful job of discussing the child. It's my job to talk for a few minutes about the adolescent, and I need to begin by making a correction. I helped to make out the program, so this correction is on me. After beginning my research, I soon discovered that the technical definition of the adolescent is a person from age 12, or approximately there, to age 20. That covers your ground, John. And it covers the next ground, too. So I'm just going to make that correction to begin with and call it the early adolescent, which is really what I'm supposed to be talking about. By definition, this is a person whose period of life falls between puberty and reproductive maturity. It's quite a transitional stage. Now, I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but if you go to the Bible to find the kind of help and instruction that we hope to share a little bit today, you will find that there's almost nothing there in detail about what you should do or what you should not do. For example, this business of touching a child. Now, we're told to spank. You find that in Scripture. But it's a little difficult. I suppose you could, if you went to certain passages, you maybe could find it there, but you'd have a little difficulty finding a passage that directly says it's very important to touch that little child as he or she grows up. Now, common sense sort of lets you know that that's the case. But it has surprised me that there just is not a great deal of explicit direction given in Scripture about the way how you should handle, let's say, the adolescent. In fact, I've always wondered why there isn't more information about Jesus Christ himself during his childhood years. I mean, you have that fairly extensive discussion about his birth. And you have that little glimpse when he's in around 12 years of age, admittedly, probably an adolescent. And that's about it. You hear almost nothing else in Scripture about how his mother handled him, how his father related to the situation. It's just silent. And so, I suppose a time like this of just reflecting on human experience and what has been learned by even secular people, thinking about that may be helpful to us in what we should actually be doing with our children as they grow up. Now, my experience as a school teacher has demonstrated something that I'd like to at least suggest to you, and you may agree or disagree. Our people do fairly well, at least in comparison to the rest of the world, for a child between 1 month or day one or even conception and the time that they're an adolescent. I can say with relative integrity that most of the children who come to the schools that I have taught in during those years are pretty well disciplined. Now, there are a few that are not, but basically they have learned the disciplines of sitting still and listening to you when you tell them to do something, and so on, with a few exceptions, granted. But I have long felt that we really, really have a serious deficiency when you get to the adolescent. I have seen this happen in the schools that I have taught in over and over. Here's a child who really is a very delightful child, a very nice child, very open, just in every respect, the kind of child you would want to be around. And somewhere between 7th and 9th grade, they come back to school from the summer. And something has happened to that child. Now, you can make some kind of a biological observation. Sometimes they've grown a foot. At least it seems like that to me. Normally, they pass me up right in about there somewhere. And some of those things you can observe. But something else that I'm talking about has also happened. I'm going to struggle here with words to describe this phenomenon, but it seems as though they have drawn away from the kind of contact that you really would like to have with them. their heart seems to have gotten more distant from you. And you're struggling with how you're going to get to their heart. And if you're a school teacher, if you're a parent, you know what I'm talking about. And even though I understood some of that myself, before my children became adolescents, I want to tell you something. I found this more difficult than I had anticipated as a father. In fact, I have in my notes here just a little reference to a time during the development of our family. Jolynn is sitting back here, and she's 20 years old now. But I remember the day when I was down on the floor tussling with my little fellas, letting them crawl over me like you instructed us. And basically what we were doing is they would come up as close as they could, and then I would leap for them, grab them, you know, and knock them down and tussle with them a little bit and so forth and so on. Jolynn was sitting on the sofa. She was about age 12. And she got off of the sofa. She doesn't remember this, I'm sure. And came over to where we were playing and started to act as if she were going to entice me to grab her and knock her down. And then I saw her withdraw. And even while I was tumbling with the boys on the floor, it occurred to me, we were in for a change. There was something happening in our relationship that was going to be different. She was no longer a child. Okay? She was moving into adulthood, going through this thing that biologists maybe call puberty or something like that. And she recognized that difference, so did I. Just kind of naturally, right? So now came the time in which I was faced with a thing that I had perceived ahead of time, and that is when this happens, you have to know what to do. My talk this afternoon is about what should we do when these children become adolescents, early adolescents, and they are going to move from childhood to adulthood. Well, life is full of transitions. Brother Tim talked about a couple of those. One of them is just from conception to birth. That's quite a transition, that single cell to the multi-cell being that is capable of feeling, hurting. And they're even telling us now that they're capable of learning while they're in the mother's womb. I'm not going to get into the details of that because I don't know. But we hear this discussion nowadays that you should play the kind of music, etc., that will actually teach the child something about your thinking and so on, even while they're in the mother's womb. I'm not so sure that the developmental stage that comes at adolescence isn't about as powerful. By that I mean so many things are set in that time that you were talking about, ages 1 to 2, more than I'm willing to accept almost, they say. And I think we see a parallel event happening in the child's life when they get to this point of adolescence. At that point, again, there is a time for setting things, setting courses, personality changes, social interaction, etc., happens at that particular point, almost as phenomenal as that early time. And that's what we want to talk about a little bit today. I just have a few things to put on the overhead projector that I would like for you to think about. I don't like this, not being able to carry the microphone along. You have to come back so that they can hear you back there. Yes. In any transitional stage, no matter if you're talking about infant to child to adult, Mary's transition, first child, midlife crisis, senior citizen, old age, whatever it is that you want to discuss, here are three major areas at the top of this list that one needs to give thought to. These are the changes that occur. The first one is very obvious, biological. This tends to be something that can be measured, something that can be seen. For example, just think about the middle-aged person. Now, there are biological changes there, aren't there? Gray hair. I can speak for that. Some people grow. And changes do occur even at that age. Now, that's not our discussion, but I'm just pointing out to you from day one until the day you die, you move through transitions, and here are just three general areas, biologically. The child, age 12, 13, 14, or whatever it may be, goes through this biological change. We refer to it as puberty. It's under the control of the endocrine system. It happens to Christians and non-Christians. It happens to spiritual people and non-spiritual people. This is going to happen to everybody. This comes on and changes occur, and you know about them. Unfortunately, the average child doesn't quite know what's going on, and is not sure how they should respond or react. And here's the place where I'm afraid that most parents trip up. Okay? The average parent at this point says, well, I learned kind of myself, and I guess they will too. Underscore the word guess. And maybe they will, maybe they won't. And maybe the way they learn won't be the way that you think they should have learned. But this, I think, is a very, very critical time. So we have these biological changes, and of course it brings on adult characteristics, etc. We have psychological changes, or changes in the way a person thinks, which I think affects education. I'll come back to that other issue a little bit later on. This is neurological development. The brain actually, we don't know how it does this, but it takes on this skill of abstracting that Tim alluded to. The ability to take a subject and think beyond just the immediate, to abstract. More about that later. And then a third area that changes is the social interaction that you have. Somebody told me that Aiden just said the other day that he has achieved a new social status, or there's been a change in his social status. And upon investigation, it's because he now has a special friend that he is relating to, and in his mind that has rearranged some of the social strata, apparently. I didn't ask him about this, but must mean something a little different. And honestly and seriously, isn't it true that when you get married and you come back from your honeymoon, isn't there something just a little bit different? Maybe a great deal different. And so when you talk to your friends and so forth, it's just a different social relationship than what it was before. Okay? Well, back to the adolescent. What is the biggest thing that happens here? Remember this. They will become extremely peer-oriented at this point. Just expect it. As a child, you can pretty much dress them the way you want. You can put the shoes on them you want. You can cut their hair the way you want. You can comb their hair the way you want. Generally speaking. Now, I know there are exceptions to this. But as a general rule, that's the case. But you wait till they're an adolescent. Or in that stage. And then they're going to say, that shirt doesn't match. I don't like this dress. I wish I could comb my hair differently. Dad, could I... I don't like your haircuts. I wish somebody else had cut my hair. And all of these things begin to develop about that time. Strong peer orientation. For teachers, this is an important thing to remember. You can expect it in your classroom. The student who the year before, you could pretty much ask him to do this or that, and he was going to do it, and he wasn't going to argue with you. He wasn't going to fuss about it at all. Wait till the next year. And he's going to be home telling mom and dad, well, everybody else is doing this. And he's also going to be telling you, or he's going to be a little more resistant to you than he was before, if you ask him to do something that is a little bit outside of the norm, outside of the general path. He's going to feel reluctant to do that. Just to anticipate it. They will be strongly peer-oriented at that particular time. The problems that you see listed at the bottom, this listing is not original with me, and you ought to know that, because I don't generally use these kinds of sophisticated terms to describe pretty much everyday affairs. things that you could speak about in more common terms. So in my research, I came up with this out of some secular stuff. And so I just pointed out to you, specific problems facing early adolescents, adjustments in heterosexual relations. This is the interest that develops in boys and girls. But here's an interesting thing. What will they do first before they express that interest out loud? Typically, they will begin to segregate themselves into various groups. For example, it's not hard to get Erickson to or Jordan to play with another girl his age. He doesn't even think about it. He'll go right out and play in the sandbox or ride a tricycle or whatever. Well, he's not riding tricycles yet, but whatever event is going on, that's no consideration of his at all, or very little. And even boys, I mean, as they get older, 7 years old, it still is not that big of an issue. But about this time, it does become an issue. And you will find them socially, the boys will gather together and the girls will gather together and the boys do boy things and the girls do girl things. Now that does not mean that they don't have any interest in each other. It just means that this is what they will do first. Segregate themselves, boys here, girls here. And any school teacher knows this who has taught 7th grade or 6th grade or in through here somewhere. You go out onto the playground, the boys don't want to play with the girls. Now I'm not saying always, but as a general rule, you'll find this. This doesn't seem like the right thing. And you'll hear them kidding each other about this type of thing. That changes about the time they're high schoolers. But at that particular point, they want to segregate some. But what this signals is that there is a growing interest. There is something changing. And one should be aware of this. Now, while I'm on that particular point, I know I picked that up a little bit later. Number 2, development of occupational orientation. Again, what a big way to say that they start to think about what am I going to do? Am I going to be a truck driver? Am I going to be a farmer? Am I interested in being a school teacher? And so on. I won't ask you to answer this question, but just think about it. How many of you are doing today what you were thinking you wanted to do when you were 12, 13, 14 years old? Do you know that the average person does not do what they think they were going to do at that age? Now, that's not true of everybody, but that's a general rule. They don't. The most amazing thing happened to me in school. I have never thought too much of a survey test that explained to you what you will be or what your aptitude is, etc. I was, at that age, wanting to be I had thought about being a farmer. I had thought about being a carpenter, a mechanic. Those were the 3 things that were heavy on my mind at that particular point. I took a test in 7th grade, and that test came back saying that this boy is suited to be a social worker. He will work better with people than anything else. I laughed at this score. I said, a teacher, a social worker working with people? No. I like tractors. I like nuts. I like bolts. I like things like that. This is wrong. Well, surprise, surprise. Sure enough, as I come into adulthood, I found out it was more accurate than I had anticipated it would be. And of course, if you'd ask me at that point, do you want to be a school teacher? I'd have had a standard answer. You must be crazy. School teacher, no. But at any rate, there is thought given to what I'm going to become. In the public school system, if I may just comment on this, this seems to be problematic to me because now they're going to put papers in front of you and ask you to sign up for kind of a program that is going to direct you into one of these areas. And it seems as though most of these people who start down these lines don't end up there anyway. I don't know what the answer to that problem is. 3, development of a mature set of values. This is a struggle for parents, isn't it? Because here's your Johnny growing up, and you have high expectations for him, and here about this time, he seems so immature, and he is, and he wants to do things that just seem to you to be very unadult. And by the way, this adolescence thing is a problem because there are times when we think they should be adults, and there are times when we think they should act like children. Did you know that? We tend to do both, depending on whatever the circumstance may be. And, well, what do you expect in a child? Well, as they develop this mature set of values, obviously we have a great deal to do with it. I'll come back to that later. Fourth, responsible self-direction. We just call this responsibility in our home. Now and then we say to our children, when you need to develop responsibility. Your bed should be made, not so much because we're ashamed of people walking in and seeing your bed not made, as much as you need to learn the responsibility of doing a daily task. This takes on stronger, has more strength about this time. Fifth, breaking of close emotional ties with parents. What is meant here, as I was reading, is that so a child will very naturally wrap their arms around you, and they're very dependent, as Tim was explaining to us. And there comes a time when there's a certain amount of breaking of this. I don't really like the wording of this. I think there ought to be a close emotional tie maintained. And I just admit to you, as I've already started out, I have found this harder to do than I imagined it would be as my children have become teenagers and grown up. A little more difficult. Sixth, an awakening spirituality. This one was not in the book that I read or in my study material. I added it on. And it's one for us to think about. This is the time in which they begin to think about what they're hearing in church and what they're hearing from parents. And they're beginning to consider, in fact, they may even begin to feel guilt feelings, true guilt feelings. Now, a child, a very young child, may be made to feel badly. And I use those terms because I don't want to be misunderstood. If I were to take our five-year-old and just really scold him, he would feel badly. I make a difference between that and what I'm terming true guilt. But it is at this time, I think, that a child begins to sense this and to be able to abstract enough to think about God in a larger sense, to think about his relationship to God and make some kind of, well, he will, either by default or in some way, make decisions about what he has learned in relationship to God. So there is this awakening spirituality, and it's not always easy to deal with. I have there at the bottom, then, factors involved in dealing with these specific problems. One, motives begin to develop. Beliefs, these are largely what the parent has taught them, I think. Anxieties is the term that psychologists like to use. I don't know why they camp on this word anxiety, but they do. Look, children have fears. They may be afraid of the night. One of the things that Brother Tim was talking about, when mother is never at home, I think this develops a fear, an anxiety, the psychologist would say, in the child that can be very destructive. These people have really made hay with this issue, I'm afraid, because, oh, I remember of reading an article that made me laugh and cry both. Not literally, but I felt like doing both, about this young man in New York City, as I recall, who had murdered his brother. I think it was a brother. Went to court, and of course they were going to put him in a juvenile detention hall of some sort, but his lawyer successfully argued that he had so much anxiety over the fact that his folks did not have indoor toilets that this had driven him to murder his brother. Well, you can see why I wasn't sure whether to laugh or cry over such a situation. Now, anxiety, yes, there's going to be some of this, and there's going to be fears, etc. But I don't think we can blame everything that we see around us on the anxiety that a person has experienced. defenses emerge, that child is more quick to argue with you. Say, well, why should I do this? Or why should I do that? And then various defensive mechanisms develop to deal with what troubles them. Okay, and it may be, you may have this child who gets really loud and boisterous, and he's in a crowd, he's talking all the time. What does that say? Is he really that big and brave and bold? Probably not. Very, very likely, if you were perceptive enough, you might realize that he has an anxiety. I'll use their term. Pretty deep-rooted, down inside, that he does not, he needs to cover up. He needs to do something with it. And that's how he'll respond. It helps a lot as a teacher or a parent if you know that. Here's the student in your classroom. And he's loud. He's boisterous. He's a difficulty. Look for some underlying cause. There's something that is making him be this way. And if you could find out, you would do better at dealing with that particular problem. And last of all, in this list of factors, we have cognitive functions, or the ability to think. And as our ability to think develops, we change our views on various things. I'd like to just say a little bit about cognitive functions, etc., for the teacher's sake here. I'll put this here on an overhead projector and just talk a little bit about those. The ability to think. Tim had talked about some of the things that happen as a child is growing up. I have here five categories that define cognitive elements: schemata, images, symbols, concepts, and rules. And it's just basically a common sense development of a child's ability to think. Young children think in terms of what they're calling here schemata, which is very, very broad, nebulous outlines. They move to images where, when they think tractor, or they think, right, if we use tractor as an example, this little fella down here that sits on my wife's lap and mine sometimes, when he gets a tractor, he puts out his tongue and he goes, okay? Tractor is a piece of noise to him, and that's the schemata. That's what he sees in that thing is this very, very nebulous thing that goes down the road. He has no idea what that thing's used for. Makes no sense to him at all, except that it makes noise, and that happens to be very interesting to a small child like that. So he'll pick up a tractor somewhere, push a car along, and make a noise of that nature. Images, you're moving a little further. When you get to something like images, you may have a child of two or three or four sit beside you in church, you get out a piece of paper and draw something, and you say to him, "What is that?" And he will say, "Well, that's a tractor." Now, it doesn't look anything like a tractor at all. You had to ask him what it was to get him to say it. But what's he working at? There are images. Okay, now he's actually able to put some kind of form to this thing in his mind. Thirdly, symbols. Now, symbols becomes a greater abstraction. Teachers, you will relate to this. Marvin, where are you at? Back here. The algebra teachers. You get the 7th grader, 8th grader, 9th grader in math class or an algebra class, and you start to put on the board letters. A plus B is equal to 9. And he looks at you and says, "What? A plus B is equal to 9. What are you doing? This makes no sense to me at all." Now, some children, if they're mature enough, will catch right on to that. And they can abstract that so simple. They see the symbolization, and they're able to use a letter A and realize that's just a symbol for some unknown factor. Well, even if you go back to reading, isn't that just symbolization? I mean, you put a symbol on a piece of paper that symbolizes a particular sound, and then you learn to copy that. Well, in child development, a child may not be able to do that at 6 years old as well as the next child who could do it at 5 years old. You have to be aware of this in child development. So symbols are very, very important. And here this adolescent is, and They're going to even use, they're going to be thinking about symbols in respect to all such things as spirituality. For example, if I drew a cross here on the wall, if I just drew a cross, to the baby it means nothing. To the next person, as adults, that meant almost a magical thing. If you wore it on a chain around your neck, it would do something, which I didn't know what it was supposed to do, but it would do something. Well, I wanted to see something differently than that. Concepts begin to develop. Teachers talk about concepts all the time. And sometimes you wonder, are these children getting this concept? Well, if they have not gone through the previous stages, they'll have difficulty with that. And rules finally emerge in the cognitive element issue. Routines involved in cognitive thinking, perceiving, remembering, generating hypotheses, evaluating, deducing. I think they speak for themselves in some. The ability to solve problems. That's about what it amounts to. Teachers, let me ask you a question. Can your students solve problems? That's pretty hard to take a child and train them to solve a problem. I hear math teachers saying this, well, some students can just do it and some can't. You give them reading problems, they can see right through it, and they read the problem, they do the problem, they solve the problem, that's it. Next child, you work and you work and you work and you work. Well, that's problem solving that begins to happen when a child moves from childhood to adolescence, and this becomes more and more and more of a skill the longer time goes on. Now, just a few comments, very practical comments to you about the adolescent. I've already mentioned that I think we do not do well during this transitional period. Now, I don't mean that to be a judgmental statement. I'm sure that there are many who do very well. But my general impression is we don't do so well. The thing that I have found with my sons that is extremely, extremely important is somewhere along the line, they must recognize, and I'll just speak bluntly, that you recognize their manhood. When you extend to them the same kind of respect that you extend to men, you respect their privacy. I mean, there is a time, you know, when a child is small that you go up and knock on the bathroom door. And if the little five-year-old is in taking a bath, well, you go in shape while he's taking a bath. There comes a time when that must change. And that child, that boy, wants that to be honored and recognized. And sometimes I'm afraid it isn't. Perhaps even more importantly in this process is for you as a father to actually be the person who sits down and gives them some instruction about what it means to be a man. I'm afraid way too much of this is just kind of left to go however it goes. Okay? That is a mistake. The simple fact that you as a father sit down and discuss this in gentlemanly, adult terms and help them to understand this lets them know that you are respecting them as men. And I'm wondering if what happens so often is not that this son grows up and here's dad, and he does really have respect, etc., for this son, but the son is uncertain if he does. He's not sure about it. And I think there's a relationship between this respect that I'm talking about and the actual ability, etc., just to sit down and talk to this son growing up about the changes in his body and what he may expect. I really would encourage fathers to do this with their sons and mothers to do this with their daughters. Now, maybe in your community circles, this is not a problem, but I grew up in a community. I went to a public school, and this is no disrespect to my father. My father did a better job, I think, than what I'm doing. And was a very, very, very good man, a very good father, still living. I have very high respect for him. But in his bringing up and in his teaching, you learned as you went. Okay, Now, I don't know what his experience was, but mine was in a public school in the 1960s, in the 1970s, and I doubt I have to say much more about the kind of training that you're going to receive in that setting if you don't have somebody to take you aside and say, could I just talk to you about this issue on a different level? And this is probably why it is somewhat of a burden to me, because I know for my generation, this is the way we went, and this is the way it happened. I just would really, really encourage you to do something differently. I want to be clear on something. I do not consider this the responsibility of me as a principal or as a teacher of a school. I consider this the responsibility of mom and dad. And hence, do not take it into my own power to go into the details of this type of thing. A second point that I would make to you is on this issue of peer orientation. What is the answer to this? So you have a child. Of our seven children, we have not detected big problems with this, but we notice that some of our children are by far more peer-oriented than others. They will take to what others are doing a lot more quickly. But what's the answer to this? Generally, to the parent who is very, very sensitive, he will respond by doing what? Taking the child and withdrawing him from those peers, taking some kind of action that makes sure that there is not contact. Well, to be real fair with you, I think that if it calls for that kind of drastic action, then do it. I do not draw on my own experience, but I am thinking of a particular person who I know very well back our way, who had a daughter. I'm sorry, it was his sister. He was telling me about this. This gentleman had a sister who had really gotten herself into a bad way in school. Peer orientation had so strongly affected her that she actually would go to town, and she didn't mind having a night out with the boys in town. Pretty bad. When her father found out about this, now she was 16, 17 years old, not really an early adolescent, kind of a middle. This is what he did. He said, "Daughter of mine, I love you very dearly. You are going to go with me everywhere we go. When we go to church, you're going with me." Now, I don't know if she sat beside him, but she went along to church. "When we go to town, you're going with me. You're not going to town alone." He literally really sat on her in that respect. I know that most people would say this was a mistake. It was life-changing for that lady. Today, she looks back on that. I have not heard this testimony myself, but her brother telling me. She looks back and says, "Boy, that was tough. And did I ever feel like rebelling? The youth were getting together, and Dad said, 'That's tough. The youth get together, I'm staying at home, you're staying at home.'" Now, I'm sure they had many long discussions. I'm sure they, knowing the father, I know they did. But that girl says, "That was a thing that saved me from just a life of utter destruction." Now, I'm not telling you that in every case this is a thing to do. I surely am not saying that. But one could at least physically pay attention to this, couldn't they? I mean, if the neighbors are just absolutely destroying your children, well, you're going to have to do something to physically keep them apart. That's what you have to do. Sometimes it surprises me at how the answers may be a little easier than what we think they are. Now, I know they're difficult at times, but that can be done. Now, I really am not in favor of extreme isolation. Don't misunderstand me. In fact, I think that's a mistake. This brother that I'm speaking of took extreme action in an extreme case. Okay? I don't hope that we are looking at cases of that nature. But let's do think about it. That's one response. Of course, the other response is to sit down and try to teach this child that you don't have to look like they do. You don't have to act like they do. You don't have to cut your hair the way they do. You don't have to wear the shoes they do. You can teach them to be men and women. And by the way, being a man and a woman is partly being able to make decisions outside of what everybody else is doing. So they all bought Chevrolets. Well, being a man is going and looking and saying, why are they buying this car or truck or whatever it is? Is it any good? Evaluating it, making a decision, and even if they all bought them, I'm going to buy a Ford. I'm not a Ford man, but we're going to do it that way. So as a parent, I feel like if we could offer the kind of honor and respect that we need to this growing child who is moving from childhood to adulthood, it would do an awful lot to smooth this experience that is oftentimes difficult through these adolescent years. I also think that it is at this point that we can do a lot for them spiritually. When this guilt, these thoughts, first begin to come into their minds, we sit down with the child and we talk to them. I'm afraid that oftentimes a child makes a response to the Lordship of Jesus Christ, I hesitate to say this, but I think it's true, a little prematurely. I really think that because they're in this transition between a time of being a child and feeling badly about not doing what their parents may want them to do or something of this nature, and the time when they will experience true guilt. Okay? And if we're not careful, what we are doing is we are working at getting them to make some kind of a decision on the basis of these bad feelings rather than on the basis of true guilt. Now, I want to be careful about that. I'm not suggesting to you that you hold them off and you don't let them do this and you don't let them do that. I don't think that's the right thing to do. But on the other hand, well, I'll say this for my son. He's not here. I think he'd be a typical example of what I'm thinking about. He grew up, I think he was 15 before he made a public commitment to the Lordship of Christ. Sheila and I did not feel uncomfortable at all about that. He was not a rebellious 12-year-older or 13-year-older or 14-year-older who just resisted everything that we wanted him to do. He just basically seemed to be the kind of person who, he wanted to please us. That's about what it amounted to. And we felt very good about that. And he felt okay about it. And he made some mistakes. And we tried to bless him even in those mistakes. But there came a time when indeed he sensed within himself that he had to make something right between him and God that was not right. That was the time in which he made his decision. I felt very comfortable with it. Some of our children have made decisions younger. I don't want to be misunderstood at the point. But think carefully about this point. And for school teachers, I think it's the same issue. I have tried steadfastly as a school teacher to put the burden of this responsibility on the parents' shoulders rather than get up and give them a hellfire sermon and attempt to get them to make some kind of a decision there in school. Now listen, I've said some hard things to teachers as students, and you can ask them about that. There are a few here. But I really like to see them grow up and prosper and come to a place where they can sit down and say, God, what is it that you want to do? And make a decision for him. If we can do this with our adolescents, I think we will see the teenage years that Brother John is going to talk about go a lot more smoothly. Thank you.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.